I'm Jonathan Hirsch, and this is Arrivals. Stories of migration, transformation, and change. The program that explores what we do when what we've done is a thing of the past. If our body were a map, it would be written in our parents' ink. Their genetic code would draw out the boundaries of our own personal world. And that map, like every other map, would change with time. The continents would grow smaller, the oceans would be wider. Our shape would change with gravity, with age. But for some, the ink that draws that map is the kind that disappears. We all live with the knowledge of our own mortality. But what about those who know more? How do you chart a course through the world when the end is a known entity? Today on Arrivals, a family and the map that they share.
If Alpha One were a person in my life, it the closest I can think of is the functioning addict, where day to day the life keeps going, responsibilities are handled, and there's maybe little interruptions in the process, but it's nothing too dramatic. But then there's the tipping point where something goes awry and the function within the addiction is gone, and it's merely addiction that is. The people in the surrounding are kind of left to assist or pick up the pieces or do their best without any loss of love or conviction for the human being that's enraptured in the process. I think after the tipping point, it's constant support. There's, like with addiction, there's never an actual end. It's merely a day-to-day reckoning with the reality of being a human being suffering from something that's often out of your control. My name is Garrett Tiedemann, and I'm from St. Paul, Minnesota. Alpha One, its full name is Alpha One Antitrypsin Deficiency. It affects you in two specific ways. One of the ways is kind of like emphysema. The second way that it can affect you is cirrhosis of the liver. My grandma was a Baptist and very much a teetotaler. She didn't drink alcohol. And so the best thing the doctors told my mom was that she had to have been hiding her drinking because they could not figure out why else she would have cirrhosis of the liver, other than that she actually was a heavy drinker and hid it. But my mom was able to tell them no because she knew everything she ate, because my grandmother couldn't tend to herself. She was just in that sort of state. If my mom wasn't taking care of her, my brother from my dad's first marriage would come home and like feed her lunch and things like that, because she could not do it herself. Is genetic, and you can test for the genetic markers that shows a variance, it's not clear how it will manifest in each person.
Growing up, there were signs, but it was
unclear what those signs meant. So my mom recalls at some point when she was with my dad, and she thought it was before I was born, she remembers at a dance getting really short of breath. And for her, that was the first time she noticed anything like that.
First signs of Alpha 1 are shortness of breath, which could be mistaken for asthma. But you can have asthma without having Alpha 1. First signs can also be liver damage, which is often mistaken for alcoholism or some form of drug abuse when that's not the case.
When I was 6 and my parents split, I have this very distinct memory that I was going through a quiet house with my brother, and we carefully opened a door very, very subtly, and I saw my mom smoking. And my mom was not a smoker. She had, in her very early years, she smoked briefly in drinking with coworkers, and that was it. And I have this distinct memory of turning to my brother and saying, "Oh, things are bad." And thinking to myself, at the age of 6, that I had to take care of myself, that my mom had too much going on, and that the only thing that would help her from me was if she didn't have to worry about me. All the doctors kept telling her that she was overweight, that she had COPD, that she had asthma, that they couldn't figure it out. She went on lots of different drugs like prednisone, which is kind of horrible for you in long doses. So I remember her being able to go on bike rides with me, and then I remember her having trouble, and that, like, the having trouble was the last time that she ever rode a bike with me. And then I remember her bike sitting in the garage unused.
Passed on to your children, though it's unclear to what extent that will be.
She had reached a place of such decline that it was very difficult to go to work. It was difficult to perform all of the things that she wanted to do, even within a physical disability, and she really needed to have something that would solve it. So I knew that she was meeting with a new doctor and that she was going through the steps of discovering what might be the actual diagnosis by trying new tests and trying new things that the doctor wanted to do. But I was also really focused that I was in the last year of college. It was in the week that I was graduating, and I remember my mom was sitting in a chair in the living room, and she was crying when I'd gotten home. And I just remember her telling me that she had gotten the diagnosis, that it was confirmed that it was what's called alpha 1 antitrypsin deficiency, and that there was no cure, but there was treatment to kind of try and keep it at bay. And at that point, when she figured that, then it was a pause. While this was a very positive moment for her, It was also significant in that because there was no cure, it would be the thing that took her life eventually.
It's a progressive loss of lung capacity, oxygen tanks, and an ongoing feeling of suffocation. Basically, you slowly lose the ability to breathe.
She learned in after the diagnosis was that it's genetic and that it's an easy test. It's a test that you can take with a spot of blood from your finger, send it into a lab, and they just look at your markers. The line, I mean, and it seems weird to say it, but I mean, I at that age, I mean, I immediately was starting to think about if I ever have kids, that means it's going there. And that means this is something I have to consider. We did it anonymously because I didn't want to have it in my health record. So she took me in to meet her doctor. I was a carrier, which is different than kind of being full-blown genetic. And so what that meant was that I got some of it from my mom, but that my dad didn't have anything. And when I learned that, I don't know if I knew what to think. Subsequently, I've seen how people who are technically, by their genetic markers, only carriers have really horrible effects from this, and in some cases have been worse off than people who are considered full-blown. For me, it's a kind of a black hole where there's not really so much a way to anticipate it. And there's quite a variance of how it could happen if it arises. And so I think at the time it was more just trying to understand that it's a good possibility it could be the thing that's going to kill me.
So if it's affected by Alpha-1, it not only affects your body's ability to process toxins, but it affects your mobility, your eyesight, and how your entire body functions.
Having at least a vision of what may be the thing that kills you and knowing that really there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, so in some regard, it's the same as the old adage, you know, we're all going to die, we just don't know when. It's colder, my lungs will start to burn. And even though I know this is kind of normal, like, it happens, it's weighted. So my response to it is always like, okay, that's kind of normal, but what if it's not? I have a general unease about my health, and I work very hard to be positive with my health, but inherently I have a sort of unsettledness about it. It's almost like an epilogue. While there's the infusion treatment that keeps it at bay, ultimately the only treatment is transplant. That if you're able to transplant the liver, you can actually or transplant the lungs because it takes so long for the effects to like truly manifest. So like, you know, 30, 40 years in most cases, though some are younger, a transplant usually then means that by you can get to the end of whatever your natural life is. I mean, my mom can't play with my daughter. You know, like she can read her stories and she can do things like that, but she cannot do what a normal 3-year-old wants to do. And it's emotionally hard on her because there's a part of experience and a part of living that she's not getting. And she sleeps with a oxygen tank every night. And so that's kind of like that adds a whole lot of burden on the body. That's like, you know what? I could imagine it just one night it gives out.
Whenever I have to fill my Helios, there are two sizes. One is the smaller unit that usually goes for about 3 to 4 hours. And then there's a larger unit that can go up to 6 hours. The real challenge is if I want to be gone for the day, I typically have to fill both to make sure I do not run out of oxygen. It's the larger unit that freezes up on my storage unit in the home. So what happens is it takes so long, it takes up to 5 or 6 minutes to fill that unit. It then freezes up and I'm not able to detach it for some time, or I have to really try to pry it loose to be able to take the unit with me. So it can be a struggle, and it's stressful because you wonder, are you going to be able to manage to get it filled without any problem, or is it going to freeze up? And so then you're going to have to get a screwdriver and try to pry it loose. I think for most of us who have Alpha 1, we struggle a lot trying to figure out so much of how we're going to adapt our lives. Our lives tend to be, you know, tipped upside down, knowing that we're going to be gradually more limited in the kinds of things we normally do. I have been in a professional career for almost 40 years, and I was very active and involved and loved sports when I was younger, and yet as the shortness of breath continued, it becomes much more difficult to be engaged in what you really want to be able to do.
Because her body is so degraded from the disease, the idea of transplantation is almost like, the question is if her body could take it. So it's like, it's a complicated thing where you say, oh, we could give you new lungs, but then like transplantation is such an invasive thing to do that then you question, is the body actually in good enough health to handle the after effects? I've always been more concerned with sort of the materiality of making stuff. And it's always been combined with the sort of idea of a philosophy of living a life that earns death, like living a life that earns a really good death, that you've done something. And so it's sort of this sort of overwhelming sense of like, I wanna earn the demise if the demise is going to be that. If it's going to be not some quick end, but a slow descent into inactivity, I want to earn that. I remember watching stuff with Jean Cocteau, and he always talked about making films that would arise after the rapture, and this idea that of making something of such weight that it would come up from the ashes and inform a new beginning. I'm not saying that I'm trying to do that, but I get the sort of sense of like in your life doing something that goes far beyond that can by some regard affect people, affect the world by its very existence. And so I just kind of internalize that, and so it's like for me very much so, it's like if the end is going to be me in a chair unable to move, I want to know I did every damn thing I could leading up to that to make something of this world.
Struggles are constantly in front of us, but it's the kind of thing that also challenges you to look at what is your next passion or what's your next kind of project you want to work on. Because I refuse to let it get the best of me.
Special thanks to Garrett Tiedemann for sharing his story. Garrett is an independent producer, a sound designer, composer. He hosts the White Whale podcast. And Garrett and I co-produced today's episode, along with help from Nora Lind and Emma Jacobs. You can find Garrett on Twitter at White Whale Pod. And links to his work can be found in the show notes of today's episode on our website, along with all of the other Arrivals episodes, at ARRVLS.com. We also release a microcast called En Route, with outtakes, extended interviews, and other inspirations from the Arrivals show, which you can find there as well. Arrivals is a proud and founding member of The Herd, an audio collective of six independent shows from across North America that have banded together to share resources and promote one another's work. One of the shows on The Herd I know you'll love is Nocturne, hosted by Vanessa Lowe. Nocturne explores how thoughts, feelings, and behaviors transform in the dark. You can listen to Nocturne and all The Herd shows by visiting our website, theherdradio.com. That's H-E-A-R-D radio.com. I'm Jonathan Hirsch. Thank you for listening. And until we meet again, may you wind up where you need to be.